Welcome back to Ask a Left Nietzschean or a Nietzschean Leftist. This is Acid Horizon and the series, which approaches the controversial question of whether Nietzsche's work is useful to leftist political thought by going directly to the folks who think it is or might be. Today on the show, we have with us Donovan Miyasaki, professor of philosophy at Wright State University and author of a two-volume study toward a Nietzschean left, put out by Palgrave Macmillan, which essentially argues that Nietzsche's most important ethical and political commitments are better realized through a form of radical egalitarianism rather than the aristocratic figure imagined by Nietzsche himself. I happen to see Donovan's work online through the magic algorithm of Nietzsche Twitter, including a blog post he recently wrote on how and why Nietzsche's fatalism or amor fati and his concept of amor fati, the love of fate, maintains implications for an egalitarian or even socialist politics. On the show, we also have Adam and Billy with us. Donovan, I want to thank you for responding to my cold invite and coming on the show today.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
Great. Perhaps you could begin by telling us a little bit about your work, your history of studying the work of Nietzsche and maybe even egalitarian politics. And how did you, in fact, come to the positions that you're committed to right now?
Well, I think I came to Nietzsche indirectly from an interest in visual art and literature. That was what I was originally studying. That led me to existentialist literature, which led me to philosophy. And Nietzsche was the one, I think, who pulled me into philosophy. So that's how I became interested in Nietzsche. I also had the benefit of being in a rather strange undergraduate department at the time. It was a small department with a very, very continental bent, as well as a very historical bent. It was very eclectic. We had a professor who had been a student of Deleuze. We had a professor who was a specialist in psychoanalytic thought. We even had a Wittgensteinian. And at the time, this was when the divide between continental and analytic was a bit more fierce. So I realized with hindsight, if I had been in a different department, I might not have left literature for philosophy. But I think Nietzsche drew me in part because he straddled those lines. He had this very aesthetic side to his work, not just to his interests, but also to his style and his approach. So that's what drew me in. I went on to study at the University of Toronto, where I did a dissertation on Nietzsche and Freud. I was comparing their theories of the drive and the unconscious and trying to explore the reciprocal implications for social and political theory. So that's really when I became more interested in the social and the political as opposed to the aesthetic. But at the time, I was kind of doing a bit of both. I was studying Frankfurt School critical theory and working on Adorno and Benjamin's aesthetics. And in my dissertation, I was also working on Marcuse and the aesthetic side of Marcuse. So I was always trying to bridge those interests. But after my dissertation, I really kind of found myself more and more drawn to social political questions, in part because of my study of the Frankfurt School and Marx. So I don't know. I guess that covers a bit of it.
That was great. That was a great introduction. And one of the reasons that your work stood out to me is actually an ongoing conversation that I've had with Billy, who's here today, on the topic of amor fati. We went back and forth over whether or not Nietzsche's love of fate was at base a reactionary concept and whether it encouraged an ethics that diminished either the emotional or normative force that was necessary to maintain a kind of revolutionary zeal. And I want Billy to give her version of that argument a little bit later. But before we do that, could you just give us an amor fati 101? What is your basic understanding of Nietzsche's idea, and how do you derive from it some of the basic implications of your general arguments?
Okay, well, maybe a good place to start is, I think, a nice place where Nietzsche describes or gives what I think is the best description of amor fati. It's a description of Goethe in Twilight of the Idols, and he describes him as a spirit who has become free and is characterized by a cheerful, trusting fatalism, according to which only the individual is reprehensible. And everything is redeemed and affirmed in the whole. So that unpacking that could be a huge thing, but let's just try and keep it simple. First of all, this relationship between the individual and the whole, I think, is crucial. Mm-hmm. Amor fati involves a vision of the world, a vision of causality that is in some sense deterministic, but it's not a mechanical determinism. It's a holistic determinism. Everything is part of the whole. Everything only exists in the whole. And so when I'm affirming my fate, what I'm affirming is my inextricable place within a whole. I'm affirming to some degree the illusory status of my individual existence. There's a certain connection here to Spinoza, right? You can see certain similarities where really there is only one thing, the whole. The individual is an event within the whole. So what am I affirming when I affirm my fate? It's not a uniquely individual fate that I'm affirming. I'm affirming the entire world, both past and future, at the same time. So I think that's one of the things that's distinctive about amor fati. Another thing that's distinctive about it is in that quote, you'll notice that he connects this to becoming free. And that's tricky and strange because he doesn't seem to accept any deep sense of free will. There's all kinds of debates surrounding this, but a strong libertarian conception of free will he clearly rejects. I think he also rejects certain versions of a compatibilist view of free will as well. Any kind of free will where ultimately I have two possible futures and my present choice is making one or the other one real. That kind of free will I think he rejects. So why would he call this becoming free? I think it's freedom from the illusion of free will. Freedom from this sense that I individually, through my choices, am creating a path, a branch of the future. So amor fati involves not just affirming the past, but affirming an unknown future of which I'm a part, because as he puts it, I'm a piece of fate. So I'm not affirming the future as something that I am completely a victim of. I am completely causally under the thumb of. On the contrary, I'm part and parcel of the fate that brings about the future. But I don't yet know what that fate is. So that's the trusting part. Amor fati means I trust that in the long run, it is the whole that counts, not me. Now, for my interpretation, this what's important about that is it means the attitude of amor fati isn't, as I put it, instrumental. I don't look at the past or at the present and look at something that might be objectionable, like suffering or misfortune or failure. And I don't affirm it by saying, well, this unpleasant thing is going to get me to this good thing. Mm. And it's justified instrumentally in that way. Instead, I don't know what the future is. I can't instrumentally justify it. More importantly, it's amor fati. It's not justification of fate. It's not tolerance of fate. It's not intellectual acceptance of fate. It's love. So how can there be this effective attitude of love towards fate? And this is, I think, a serious problem that I try to fix. I try to resolve by looking at the will to power. I have a kind of controversial way of interpreting the will to power. I think Nietzsche interprets it in two very different ways. One, which is primarily quantitative. Power is measured by superiority, quantitative superiority in some respect to someone or something else. And then the other, which is qualitative. Power is about feeling. The feeling of power is based in resistance. It's based in action against some kind of relatively equal obstacle. And that feeling of resistance is the feeling of power. So another way of putting this is the quantitative view says the will to power is a drive towards overcoming. That's the most common interpretation. The alternate way of thinking about it is the will to power is a drive towards resisting activity for its own sake, which I stress is an anti-teleological way of thinking about the will to power. My motive isn't towards the end state that I reach. It's towards the feeling of power I get from struggling against a resistance. So that's where the love comes in, right? The possibility of amor fati is the possibility that we can find ourselves in circumstances where what seems on some level objectionable, what seems to be suffering or loss or misfortune, can still be on some level enjoyed. It can be the source of a feeling of power rather than instrumentally justified. Mm-hmm. And that's the beginning, I think. There's a rather complicated connection of this to the social political question. But that's the beginning. If it's possible for there to be circumstances in which some individuals can affirm suffering as a source of the feeling of power, regardless of success, regardless of whether you overcome an obstacle, then it's possible for there to be social organizations in which there is a kind of egalitarianism of power, where people are proportionately equal in power of all kinds, right? Economic, political, social recognition, but also material, so that they're unable to overcome one another and yet still able to affirm their difference from one another in that condition of equal power.
Great. I would actually like to tease out just a little bit more of that before I hand it over to Billy. I'd like to look at things at the more individual or particular level, especially against the very real sociopolitical backdrop within which we all live. I'm thinking, for example, those of us who live in the global north versus those who live in the global south, and the extant global capitalist political relations that we live within. It might be argued that the social pressures, the political pressures are very different, perhaps even qualitatively different, that bear upon not only individual people, but maybe even localities and so forth. How does the notion of amor fati come in when the experience of people living in a more privileged spot in the globe versus those? And I mean, look at the times that we're living in right now with climate change and those who, are experiencing these pressures in a more intense and radical way, arguably. How are we to make, how are we to find solidarity or at least a consistency within the concept of amor fati that makes it reasonable to make it a revolutionary political concept? And I'm not sure if I've explained that quite right, but how do we account for the differences that already exist within the world that we have created historically?
Right. This is a question about the conditions that enable amor fati. Mm-hmm. And one of the positions that I take is that that amor fati is primarily an end, not a means for Nietzsche. It's his criterion for measuring what we're aiming for. We want to create a world in which power is proportionally equivalent enough. And I should maybe say a little something about what I mean by that. Proportionate equality doesn't mean absolute equality. It doesn't mean static relationships. Mm-hmm. But it means that in our relationships with one another, these relationships are not debilitating. Everybody can participate. Everybody can succeed to some degree. They're not dominating. No one's going to, for the most part, lose out. Mm-hmm. And they're not demoralizing. The power differences aren't so great that you lose the desire to play the game or to participate. It's a feeling of hopelessness. So it's a degree of fluctuating near equality rather than absolute equality. So if amor fati is the criterion of higher types, as I argue, then the goal is to create a politics which will produce the conditions for that. And so what you're describing is precisely why amor fati is largely impossible under our current social political circumstances. And amor fati won't get us there. Amor fati would be the outcome rather than the means. And this is part of a broader issue that I raise, which is I argue that Nietzsche's political philosophy is rather unique in that he comes to it fairly late. He's forced to it by his moral philosophy. His moral philosophy collapses. He's trying to find a foundation for a criterion of value to replace old values. And he's trying to find a way to cultivate higher types through what are fundamentally cultural and moral means. And the more he moves in this direction of a kind of fatalism, a rejection of free will, the more he recognizes that moral and cultural means of persuasion and human transformation aren't possible. Mm-hmm. That our moralities, our value systems, and our psychological type are outcomes, not causes. They're the products of social systems and the material conditions in which social systems arise. So if you want to change moralities, if you want to change values, if you want to change individuals, you basically have to manufacture new individuals by creating new social material conditions in which they arise. That's how I interpret the genealogy, not as a genealogy of morality, so much as a genealogy of politics from material conditions, which then have as a further outcome moralities. So amor fati can't help us. That's the negative side of this concept. It won't get us there. It's what we're aiming for. But it does tell us what kinds of conditions could make it possible. And they're, of course, as you point out, radically, radically different than the ones we exist in. Although, of course, Nietzsche is going to try to make the case that we can produce amor fati among an elite few through radical inequality among the many, or with the many. And that's something I take exception to. I argue he's mistaken about.
Great. Thank you, Donovan. Billy, go for it.
Hi, Donovan. Thanks so much. I mean, it's so interesting. I started this with kind of a few questions, and I've now already filled out the page, so I might need to go and get some more paper. It's kind of one of those cases where it's very much, you know, say the line, Billy. I'm going to come and sort of say what I pretty much always say, which is that I just don't see why I should love fate. And there's one specific moment that you said is that we need to affirm the world in its totality. And this is just one of those things where I can think that the world is probably the last thing that I want to affirm. And it seems like the affirmation of the world is precisely the form of ideology. And I'm going to try and explain a little bit about why I think this form of amor fati is ideology. So, for example, your position, really interestingly, that amor fati is an end rather than a means, I think complicates this. But of course, it's still envisaged as an end by us right now. So although it might not help us as a tool, for example, it nonetheless retains a kind of connection to the actuality that we want to escape, insofar as it is an image of a fate that we are loving, right? We are envisage ourselves in a particular form of transformed material circumstances, material conditions, and attempt to kind of engender those. And so for me, the question, the issue is that it ends up sounding quite a lot like you want to get yourself to a place where you are at peace with what you already are, which is Stoicism. Which I think is the enemy of all radicalism, basically, because it sounds quite a lot like Seneca, like, you know, everyone else, you know, I'm here in my golden room, right? And all these people over here just need to kind of accept their situation. And I agree, and I can see that that's definitely, you don't think Nietzsche's doing that. But what I can't quite get is why he is, in fact, not doing that, because it sounds, again, a lot, or if he isn't doing that deliberately, I think he might be doing so a little bit unconsciously because, for example, the forms that he tends, you know, the kinds of character, the kinds of virtue that he wants us to get are drawn from the past, for example, always necessarily so. That's nobility, it's courage, it's a kind of individual will to escape, this will to power. And the kind of big problematic that I think in some ways Nietzsche articulates better than any other thinker, but also doesn't quite manage to think about himself, is exactly why should we will a certain image of amor fati? And to what extent are our images of amor fati conditioned by what we want to escape? And if they are, then are they ever right? And this to me seems to be the problem of radicalism. You know, how, you know, Marx says no recipes for the cookshops of the future. You know, Fisher says, you know, you can't imagine a future without capitalism, or rather Jameson does. And if that really is the issue, then why is Nietzsche in his vision of amor fati not willing the existent but willing something beyond it? Why do you think he's getting away from it? And this is just what I always say. So there you go. But it's a fascinating discussion already.
Wow, this is really interesting. There's so many points of connection here and points of difference in interpretation. But I'm really glad you brought up Stoicism because that's precisely the way of interpreting amor fati that I'm trying to kind of offer an alternative to. I'm not sure which issue to address first, but let's start with where you left off, which is the image of a future versus actuality. And I think this picture of a kind of holistic determinism that Nietzsche is putting forward is an attempt to reject that kind of division. I'm refusing to know what my fate is. I'm refusing to know what the final state of things will be. And in some sense, I'm refusing to even think of the world in terms of a final state. So he's trying to avoid giving us an image of the sort that you're suggesting. But that doesn't mean it's empty of content. What is it that I'm affirming? I'm not affirming a specific picture of the world. I'm affirming the fundamental nature of the world in any moment, which is that it consists of this constant, endless conflict of forces and powers. I think that's the image that he wants us to affirm, which is there's always going to be resistance. There's always going to be change. There's always going to be suffering of some kind. And so we want to ask, what possible ways can we organize our world to be able to love that fact? And it doesn't give us, you know, it doesn't give us a recipe. It doesn't give us a specific picture of the social order. The broad outline, which I tried to sketch, is if multiple people are going to be able to love their fates, then for most of their lives, most of their relationships are going to need to consist of forms of suffering, forms of struggle to the degree that they do, forms of misfortune that are relatively consistent with the feeling of power. And so this is why the normative question becomes an issue. Why should I affirm my fate? It's not the case that I should, and in most cases I cannot. I seek to have a fate that I can affirm. In the present, not knowing my future, I try to create a fate that I can affirm. Nietzsche's own life is perhaps a really interesting example. His life is a series of failures. It's a life full of physical suffering. It's a life full of emotional disappointment and suffering. And yet he does seem often to derive a kind of satisfaction in his attempt to create a philosophy, despite his academic failure, his failure as far as his reception goes, his failure in his relationships, and so on. He really does seem to, even as he suffers, derive some kind of immediate satisfaction from it, at least to some degree at some times. So to the degree your life takes that form, the kinds of suffering you experience still preserve a form of power, it then becomes possible for you to have a morphati. It's not a question of whether you should or should not. And this is the principal difference from the Stoic version. His determinism doesn't allow for us to voluntarily become people with a morphati. A morphati is a condition, it's a type. It's a lucky hit that he wants to maximize through social organization. And so we're lucky or we're not. We're in circumstances that can permit a morphity or we aren't. And so our goal then is to, since we don't know our future, to promote a more affirmable future for ourselves, but ultimately to recognize, and here's the revolutionary side, first of all, to recognize in this picture of fate, we're just a piece of fate, right? As individuals, we play an active role in fate, but it's a very, very small one. And the real isn't the individual, it's the whole. So if I really want to produce an affirmable future, I have to do it collectively. I can't do it individually. That's the first side that's revolutionary. The second side is that the goal of a morphati and the conditions that enable it is very, very different from the Stoic. The Stoic aim is a state of non-perturbedness. It's a state of kind of contentment. But in Nietzsche's case, what I'm trying to affirm is not a particular state, but the activity. Going back to that idea of will to power, the goal of will to power is the activity of resistance, the feeling of power I get in resistance, and not the state that I achieve through it. So in some ways, this is ideally suited to revolutionary activity because revolutionary activity aims at an unseen future that I don't yet know when it will arrive if it will arrive, and if I'll be there to enjoy it. So I have to be able to be driven towards the fight itself and to be able to take meaning and pleasure in the struggle, regardless of whether I'm winning or losing, in order to sustain it. And I think that's really the heart of the kind of freedom that he is attaching to Amor Fati when he says Goethe became free. He had this cheerful fatalism. That cheerful fatalism is the pleasure of a struggle that is perpetuated and may not succeed. It is the pleasure of struggle for its own sake, which enables the activity, which may have revolutionary consequences, but it also may not, or I may not live to see them. So it's the opposite of stoicism. It's not satisfaction. When I'm affirming fate, I'm affirming the contradictions and the conflicts of fate. I'm affirming being dissatisfied with the present. I'm affirming the relative negation of the present and my present circumstances. I'm not content with my situation. I am content with being discontent with my situation, is maybe a perverse way of putting it, which motivates me to enjoy fighting it, objecting to it. The final end of that description of Goethe is he no longer negates. And here we have to be careful. What does that mean? He no longer negates in the sense that Nietzsche objects to, which is the abstract negation of the core characteristics of the real. For example, in religion, I negate mortality and imagine eternity. I negate the body and imagine the soul, right? That's a kind of just the opposite of what's actual. But under this very sort of holistic picture of fatalism, if I negate the present, I have to do it in a way where I picture a future that derives from the present, that even derives from the things I dislike about the present. So it's not an abstract negation of the present. I see the future as something that has its possibility in realities that exist, rather than in just wishful thinking for a different world. And again, that goes back to this idea of the will to power. The will to power is the fundamental reality that he thinks any future possibility would depend on. So if we're going to imagine a society in which Amor Fati becomes possible, it has to be compatible with our drive towards power. But the big question then is, what is this drive towards power? And I take a very unusual position on that.
Billy, a response before we get Adam in?
Yeah, sorry. But it strikes me that you sound in some ways quite like Nietzsche. At one moment saying something which I completely get. And then at the next moment you'll say something which I go, I'm not quite sure how that squares. So for example, that moment like where you said we have to imagine this future, and which sounds quite a lot different to the idea that we just focus on the act of resistance within the present. Now, there is this sense in which I think Nietzsche has a number of contradictions internal to his thought, his contradictions regarding women. At some points he's, you know, opens with, what if truth was a woman? What then? At other moments, he's, you know, the worst misogynist you've ever read. At one moment, he praises the Jews for their resistance, and at another, he's horrifically anti-Semitic. This is a point that Gillian Rose makes really nicely in an essay in Judaism and Modernity. But what I wanted to ask, lastly, is, or rather, perhaps to just to respond, is while I can see that the idea is that you become discontented or contented with your act of discontentment, that sounds quite a lot like liberalism, actually. So liberalism says it's within your capacity to change things alone by changing your attitude towards the material conditions and coming to and basically by becoming one with your fate, basically. And there is this kind of contradiction within liberalism, right, where it says everything was within your capacity to change it, and yet, of course, the only thing that you can change is the fact that you realize that you can't change anything. And so you get this kind of contradictory position. And so for me, that force of resistance without end, I see that as a kind of end in itself, is starting again to sound like a kind of negative form of stoicism, where one is happy with your lot as a discontented actor. I want contentment, and so do you, and so do we all, right? We all wish that things were better, and that kind of positive content, right, is internal to our thought, and we're never getting out of the positive, we're never getting out of the negative, right? This is I think, kind of the point of dialectical thought. And so for me, I suppose, and I'm not expecting you to respond because I'm going to always say this. And Craig and Adam have tried many times to get through to me, but it seems to bounce off my skull. Perhaps I just don't see it. It seems to me that, again, there seems to be this moment of affirmation here of something, whether that's dissatisfaction or, you know, a satisfaction in the dissatisfaction. I wonder whether it still remains a little bit too happy with what is, rather than anything else. Anyway, sorry about that.
Oh, very interesting. And so many, again, so many points we could draw on and explore further. And I'm glad, as with Stoicism, I'm glad you brought liberalism in, because again, it's an important point of contrast. On the last point, I think there's a disagreement here that Nietzsche has with the idea that we want contentment. Obviously, the question is, what do we mean by contentment? But I think there is a deep sense in which Nietzsche thinks we don't want contentment, or what we often talk about as contentment is a state of what I would call a kind of balance of powers in which we're able to engage in activities where we continually feel power without feeling debilitated, dominated, or demoralized. Right? That's what contentment is. And it can take many forms. It could be a very quiet, peaceful activity like gardening, or it could be some really sort of ambitious, difficult struggle like, I don't know, an athletic activity. But whatever activity we find our contentment in, I think for Nietzsche at the end of the day, the pleasure is in the play. It's not in the outcome. It's not in what we're achieving. It's not in the meaning of the task. It's in sort of the engagement of equal resistance. It's in a kind of activity for its own sake. This is maybe even a little bit Aristotelian on Nietzsche's part, that the highest happiness has to be an activity that is pursued for its own sake. And it can't be contentment in the sense of the absence of activity, the absence of need, the absence of desire for activity. So I think maybe there's an important issue there. Do we, in fact, desire contentment? When we desire a different social order, if we desire a more egalitarian society, or if we desire a socialist society, is what we're desiring contentment, or is what we're desiring is a kind of social framework in which we can engage in more satisfying activities in a more satisfying way? And if it's the latter, then I think the Nietzschean picture might work, because we're asking what kind of social structure will support and preserve human relationships which are balanced, and more balanced in a very broad sense. Of course, every activity is a change of power, an expenditure of power, a building of power, but in the big picture, balanced. I should also mention, just in passing, you mentioned the dialectical, and I do think we cannot synthesize Nietzsche with Marx in that respect. I don't think Nietzsche can be a dialectical thinker. And this goes hand in hand with that. The condition of human existence is the exercise of power. The exercise of power doesn't aim at contradiction. It doesn't aim at inequality, but it does produce it. So wherever you have activity, you have changes in relationships of power. And so you can't ever have a kind of synthesis. You can't bring contradictions to an end. So if that's part of the objection, then I think that's a fair objection. Nietzsche can't be made dialectical. Maybe he can, but I think you would have to take out more than I want to take out. That would be bigger surgery than I'm trying to perform. The liberalism part. One of the objections Nietzsche makes to liberalism is he says that freedom is found, the highest kind of freedom is found five steps from tyranny. It's found on the threshold of servitude, which is an argument that you need constraints, you need obstacles, you need resistances to build freedom, but also to feel freedom. So that goes back to the version of the will to power I'm arguing for, where what we actually seek is resistance. And we're happy with that, provided it's proportionately equal. If it's too great, I feel powerless. If it's too little, I feel powerless. There's no pleasure in defeating an incredibly weak foe. So I need that proportionate quality. So freedom is in that weird middle ground, just enough, a worthy opponent. And so when I stress that his view of amor fati is I'm affirming that I'm constantly going to be encountering resistance, and I'm only able to do that if the resistance I encounter really is proportionately equal. This goes hand in hand with his rejection of liberalism, because what liberalism wants is negative, predominantly negative conceptions of liberty, where the introduction of constraint, the introduction of resistance, the introduction of obstacles is felt as a violation of my freedom. So this is another way of interpreting amor fati as freedom. It's freedom from the need for free will, because I enjoy obstacles. I enjoy opposition. I enjoy disagreement, and I enjoy fighting against it. And so, unlike the liberal, I'm not going to flee constraint. I'm not going to flee imposition. I'm not going to flee intervention, because it's the source of my feeling of power. So in that sense, I think he's trying for a very, very anti-liberal conception of freedom. Well, maybe not anti-liberal, but it's certainly not liberal. And I think it coincides with a picture of amor fati that doesn't fit the dominant spirit of liberal conceptions of freedom, where I want to avoid anyone who's going to interfere with me. I want to avoid others in general. They are an obstacle to my feeling of freedom, because I have this very deluded sense where freedom is nothing touching me, nothing interfering with me.
Right? Great. Adam.
Yes. Thank you so much. I mean, I have a sort of a bundle of questions, so I'm just going to compress into one, because your reading of amor fati is very much, it seems to me, based on specifically the late Nietzsche, particularly the Nietzsche of Twilight of the Idols, and it seems particularly the four fundamental errors section, you know, where he says, and one of the four fundamental errors is sort of people think backwards about consciousness and the will. And this goes through, and I guess we can definitely go into discussion about material conditions on this, Nietzsche's obsession with diet and with stomach and with eating. Of course, due to his own sort of medical predilections, but also the idea that, you know, one does not have a good constitution because of a good diet, one eats a good diet because one has a good constitution. And therefore, to, you know, to use the philosophy of mind technical term, the experience of the subject or any kind of subjectivity is epiphenomenal. It is a product rather than being a reflexive impulse of a sort of a transcendental subjectivity finding itself in experience. And to that extent, yeah, I wanted to ask how much, to what extent does your reading of Nietzsche exclude any principle of subjectivity? And to that extent, insofar as we are not to simply choose, we're not free to choose, but nonetheless, there's a question here of politics where there's a question of, well, are we free to choose to engineer the coming to be of the kind of types that make amor fati possible? And to that extent, insofar as amor fati is itself a position where the, you know, existence does not need to be justified, insofar as it accepts sort of a fundamental groundlessness of all of these things other than the will to power, why would Nietzsche engage in such a practice as philosophy in order to do this? I mean, you could have to sort of the answer of say we didn't have a choice in a way. You know, he was being piloted by this grand task, and that is why he chose the monikers of such, you know, Dionysus the Crucified and Zarathustra in order to carry this out. But there's not only an interpretive question here, but it's also, I mean, there is an interpretive question. There's a question about how much subjectivity or lack thereof would also differentiate your reading from someone like Heidegger, particularly volume 3 and 4 of his Nietzsche lectures, where he says, and this is just a quote, he focuses on the figure of the overman, and he says that the overman is, and I quote, "the consummate subjectivity of will to power is the metaphysical origin of the essential necessity of the overman." And this is Heidegger's big fixation that goes from the Nietzsche lectures over to his finals of public series, What Is Called Thinking, where Nietzsche essentially is a completion of a German idealist evolution in philosophy. It's Hegel at the end for Heidegger in the 30s, it's Schelling for who Nietzsche ends up completing by transmuting all metaphysics into will into the 60s or so. So I just wanted to ask, how in a sense would you say that is subjectivity one of the main parts, this focus on epiphenomenalism, one of the ways that you break with the tradition of thinking about Nietzsche as a totality-oriented political agent, you know, like Heidegger, and also insofar as you sort of stick with this hard determinist, non-compatibilist, explicitly sort of late Nietzsche, to what extent do we have the agency to even take this on board? Is it simply is it something we can choose, or is it something we have to be, in a sense, infected by? Not in this sort of sense it's a disease, but in a sense it has to rewrite us as we read it in order to make it into some sort of not only a program, but more like programming.
Thanks. This is really, really fascinating questions and really relevant. First, I should mention, as you say, this is an interpretation based in the final writings of Nietzsche, very intentionally so. I start my book by saying we're going to read backward. We'll start with his very final works, ask what's crucial and primary in those final works, and then we'll work backward and we'll include anything we can keep consistent with those final commitments. So it is very much a reading of the late Nietzsche. I even distinguish his final year, the works from the final year, from things like Beyond Good and Evil and Genealogy. On the question of Heidegger, I should just admit there's no sympathy on my part with Heidegger's reading at all. So I'm not even sympathetic enough to engage it, which I'm willing to admit. Sometimes you have to do that. Ideally, you know, you would engage and explain your disagreements with any major interpreter, but Heidegger's one, I'm not willing, I'm going to, looking away shall be my only negation. On the question of subjectivity, I do sort of read Nietzsche as treating subjectivity as pretty much epiphenomenal. The subject is a product of social systems. And at the end of the day, our choices and our actions are consequences of the organization of our drives. And the organization of our drives, to the degree it's not biological, is a product of social organization. It's a reflection of the internalization of certain moral systems. And those moral systems, in turn, are products of the social order. Take, for example, in the genealogy, you create a noble class, you create a slave class. They live side by side in completely different worlds, constantly experiencing each other. So the slave constantly has their resentment reactivated by the constant presence of the noble. The noble, in turn, has their sense of superiority constantly reactivated by the presence at a distance of the servant. And so those moralities are themselves consequences, effects of the social order, the individuals as types, the slavish psychology, the noble psychology, are effects, causal effects, outcomes of those moralities in that social order. So it really does mean that at the end of the day, subjectivity isn't something independent, and it doesn't preserve any kind of fundamental causal independence from the world that produced it. I sometimes compare this to a kind of machine or a factory, and I say that Nietzsche's politics is an industrial politics of breeding. Or another way of putting this is, I use Kafka as a slogan here, there's hope, but not for us. The individuals who currently exist can't be fundamentally changed. You and I can't fundamentally change ourselves, and we can't fundamentally change each other, and we can't save each other. Who knows, in the short term, you know, we might be able to improve our lot a little bit. But at the end of the day, what is the task of politics? It's to create new people. It's to create the conditions for future people who will be more fortunate than we have been. And so that brings us to the real serious question that you raise. If this hard determinism is the case, how is that possible? How are we even free to engage in this industrial politics of creating the material conditions of more fortuitous, happier, more fate-loving people? And I think the short answer is we're not free to do it. So Nietzsche can only appeal to the persuaded, right? He can only say to those who want that end, these are the most effective means for bringing it about. And that would go back to that question about our vision of the future. Nietzsche isn't giving us a picture of the end state. He's instead saying, well, we have to look at all of life as one causal whole. And even in the short term, the next step, what we do tomorrow, what we do next year, has to in some way be an action that derives from the current state of things. Just to give you a non-Nietzschean example of both amor fati and this version of non-free politics, think of the way Marx looks at capitalism. Think of the way he, on the one hand, affirms it. He redeems it by showing us that it is a path to socialism. But then also think of the way he's charting a minimal course towards socialism from capitalism. So he's taking the actual, he's even taking the worst parts of the actual and using them to explain causally how we get to the next step, even though he can only get us to the next step. He can't really paint a bigger picture than that. I think there's a similar situation for Nietzsche, even though he has a different end. You have to look at the present. You have to look at the past. You have to explain the next step as a causal development from what exists. And you also have to draw on existing motives and intentions to get there. You can't transform people to get there. So in the case of capitalism, you can't turn the capitalist into a socialist. You have to show how it might be in their interests to change the system in certain ways that will bring about its collapse rather than actually convert them. Right. And the same with the proletariat. You don't morally persuade them that a certain end is good. You help them see that their existing incentives already give them reason to participate in a certain kind of organized political action. So that's the general answer. The general answer is you have to work from the incentives and the kinds of human beings that already exist. And from the conditions that already exist, you can't freely persuade people to engage in this politics. And so in some sense, Nietzsche, I think this is part of the reason why Nietzsche is always trying to select his audience. He's always very aware of how is this statement or this rhetoric going to affect one audience member versus another. His rhetorical ploys are an attempt to get around this, and I think it fails. And it's not until the final works that he realizes rhetoric isn't going to do it. I need to find who already agrees with me and then convince them that this is the causally more effective path, primarily to convince those who are using moral and cultural means to get to his end to instead focus on material means. I think that's the heart of his final position.
Wow, time really flies when we're having fun. We're about 15 minutes into the discussion, and I did not want to lose something that I thought was very important in your book. One of the key arguments that you present is that the achievement of higher types or flourishing of forms of life capable of bringing about a more enlivened society, however we want to term it, depends upon Nietzsche rejecting Nietzsche's concept of the pathos of distance for what you call or what you adopt this other term, the pathos of difference. Could you briefly explain Nietzsche's concept and the distinction that you argue for and why the latter is better suited for a Nietzschean left? We might have already brushed past this, but I think amidst this discussion of drives and creating politically, the term that comes to mind is a plane of consistency whereby various drives can find their voice, seems to be what the pathos of difference offers, but maybe I have that wrong. Perhaps you could speak to that.
You definitely have that right. Yeah.
Okay.
So maybe it might be helpful to sort of mention a kind of big picture claim that I make in the book, which is based on my interpretation of will to power, I emphasize Nietzsche's concept of the manifold soul as his picture of the higher type. He gives us many different pictures of higher types, but I think this is the one that's most consistent with his core commitments. And the manifold soul is one which is not rigidly hierarchical in the organization of its drives. That's the master type. Even the sovereign individual is something of a similar type where the order of the drives is primary. In the manifold soul, instead, what you have is what I'm calling proportionate equality of the power of the drives, so that you have a multidimensional self full of many, many different sort of undersouls, as he calls them, different persons within you. And each one of those selves or drives is powerful enough that it is never entirely dominated by the others. It can express itself. It can find its own unique form of satisfaction and happiness. So the manifold soul, then, I argue, is the most consistent, best version of Nietzsche's conception of higher types. And the manifold soul then becomes the image of what a society that promotes amor fati would have to look like. Society would then also have to have many, many different individuals and groups, which have proportionately equal power, so that they can pursue their own unique forms of happiness, pursue the development of their own unique versions of self, without either completely dominating others and without being completely dominated by others. I go on further in the book to argue that that could only be maintained through the control of the economy. It can't be achieved under capitalism, and it can't be achieved under liberalism either. But anyway, that's sort of the bigger picture. And the pathos of difference versus the pathos of distance is a way of countering his argument that aristocracy as a political system is the necessary means to promote higher types. Now, at this point in the book, this is the second book, I'm no longer finding an alliance with Nietzsche's core, what I call his meta politics, right, his foundational views. I do think those are compatible with leftist thought, but by the time I get to this point, I'm focusing on the things that are not compatible. And so this is a direct rejection of something in Nietzsche, but it's a rejection that doesn't simply displace his view with an external view, but it takes what I think is sort of the best of Nietzsche, the qualitative theory of the will to power. Remember, the idea that the will to power is a will towards resisting activity for its own sake. Nietzsche isn't always consistent about that. Sometimes he takes the quantitative view, and his argument for aristocracy depends on that. I think on some level he knows this. I think he realizes that the various ways he describes the will to power don't always line up. And I think he realizes that if he acknowledges his own qualitative descriptions of will to power, his argument for aristocracy falters. And so he purposely avoids dealing with it when he's making his case for aristocracy. So let's take the case of the will to power as a drive towards distance rather than difference. I seek power in the sense of superiority over others. My pathos of distance, the pleasure I take in distance, the happiness and pride I get from the feeling of distance is specifically an indirect self-affirmation. I look at the outcome of my struggle and I see that I've won. I look at the scoreboard and I compare my score to yours. And once I make that comparison, I can say I'm the more powerful. And now I can affirm myself. That's the form of affirmation that coincides with a quantitative sense of the pathos of distance. Notice, I don't think this is trivial, that the structure of that evaluation is slavish. I look outward. I don't spontaneously affirm my own happiness. I don't discover I'm happy until I've compared my score to yours. To my mind, this is the form of the pathos of distance that aristocratic forms of society promote. It promotes, first of all, measuring your value and worth indirectly through comparison to others. And it promotes measuring your worth and your value according to a socially imposed criterion of value. In a literally aristocratic society, the way I establish my superiority is through a shared system of value, the class system, right? So in order to evaluate myself in this way, I have to conform to the values of the social order. So this is another way in which I think the quantitative version of will to power leads to a version of the pathos of distance, which does not meet what Nietzsche is really aiming for. It doesn't give us the kind of society he wants. It's not going to make people higher. It's going to make them conform to social values. It's going to make them more dependent on comparison to others in order to affirm themselves. It's going to make their happiness, their power, and their pleasure more dependent on comparison to others. Whereas the pathos of difference is the enjoyment of difference. It's the enjoyment of distance in proximity. When I encounter someone who's radically opposed to my views, or I encounter someone who's better than me, more talented, more able, or even less able, and I'm able to interact with them in a way that I take pleasure in, that's the pathos of difference. And why am I taking pleasure in this? Because they're sufficiently equal that I still experience resistance. So the pathos of distance is a valorization of difference against sameness. Here, it's helpful to think of Nietzsche's most notorious comment about equality. He says at one point that the true voice of justice would be equality for equals, inequality for unequals. Never make unequals equal. The most literal translation of this is never make difference the same. Difference for the different, sameness for the same. That's what Nietzsche confuses, right? He confuses equality in the sense of equal power with sameness. Equality in the sense of everybody has the same values, everybody has the same type, everybody has the same personality, everybody has the same life. And those aren't the same, right? And what produces one isn't the same as what's going to produce the other. And my argument is that an aristocratic system is more likely to destroy qualitative difference. And an egalitarian system where everyone has the power to participate and the power to preserve their identity against other powers is better suited to his goal of preserving the will to stand out, as he puts it, preserving qualitative difference through qualitative equality. So does that make sense? So that's a short version of a lot of different things.
No, thank you very much. Here's just a question, and perhaps a challenge to this is, and correct me if I'm wrong on any of these points, I'm imagining that there's at least at minimum a form of constituent politics at work here. And if I'm not mistaken, you did suggest that, you know, in passing in the book, that maybe there would be something like a state. But it seems that the way that we want to use the pathos of difference, it has quite a destituent quality to it, where in order to preserve the equality of equals in a society, or at least create the conditions by which, you know, these multiple drives, these multiple voices could speak, it raises the question of how a society then would maintain its consistency, such that something from the outside couldn't come in, a force from the outside couldn't come in to disrupt what might be this sort of like tenuous set of axioms that allow this particular kind of society to exist. And I know I'm speaking in the abstract here, but I mean, the forms of socialism and Marxism that we've seen throughout the 20th century, you know, eventuated in forms of the state that then collapsed and, you know, turned into forms of imperialism and capitalism and so forth. How does this all chalk up in real terms? I mean, is there a way that you imagine the future of something like a socialism or a Marxism that engenders some of these Nietzschean elements that you're importing into the system?
Right. This is an excellent question and a really big question, and definitely not one that I try to answer in the book. That's sort of a future question. But at the end of the day, as you mentioned, this isn't a form of social relationships that can be on a large scale preserved. That balance, that semi-equilibrium, I call it a tension equilibrium of powers, can't be preserved. It's constantly going to be upset. It's constantly going to be transformed. This is why also I want to say Nietzsche can only be an anti-dialectical leftist if he was forced to become one. You can never reach a synthesis. You're always going to have the reintroduction of conflict, the reintroduction of contradictions. And you have to have some form of state to reestablish power equilibrium. Now, how that's done is an open question. That's the question about recipes and cookshops, right? But the short answer is, any way we can expand the real practical power of individuals over every aspect of their life is going to move us closer to this. So, for example, increasing our power over the economic sphere is one important way of doing this. So much of our ability to participate in various social activities and social games, our ability to participate as equals in those games, have at their basis economic advantage, right? And so to the degree people control the economy, you have a greater balance of power. But this should be expanded everywhere it can, right? Control over the workplace. It should be expanded in the sort of standard frameworks that we talk about egalitarianism, because communism isn't necessarily egalitarianism. But in the standard frameworks, we talk about different kinds of equality. Equality of what? Equality of social recognition, equality of legal rights, equality of resources, equality of outcomes, and so on. And the short answer is it would have to be equality of all those things, or greater equality of all of those things, because each of those counterbalances the other. Greater social recognition doesn't necessarily lead to greater material equality, and vice versa. Right. So you need both. So at the end of the day, I don't think there's any kind of limit. We need to have as many different possible ways in which each individual, from the beginning of their life to the end of their life, can reestablish relationships of proportionate equality. And that may often mean leaving one kind of relationship and establishing that relationship in another sphere. So in one activity, your profession, you are unable for some reason to establish that kind of equality. You need to have the material opportunity and resources to go do something else where you are an equal, right? So I think in some sense, this picture demands a kind of flexibility, an equality that gives us a flexibility, the ability to constantly change our relationships to reintroduce the balance when it's lost.
Yep. Thank you, Donovan. Adam or Billy, do you have anything to add? Any other questions? By all means.
I mean, first count, in terms of any Hegelians who may be listening who are sort of screaming at the fear that trying to make Nietzsche a dialectical thinker here. I mean, I can see there are some resonances of Donovan, what you're saying about the state between Nietzsche and Hegel, which I think may come to a lot of people's mind, particularly the idea of the state, the main category of dialectics shifting in how we stand it from synthesis more to a kind of theory of mediation and totality, and the idea of a state that can mediate individual property owning or people trying to appropriate parts of the social world they live in, disputes over contract and the like. You can see a strong resonance there. However, of course, for the Hegelians wondering, that would require Nietzsche and Hegel to have the same theory of property, which relies upon subjectivity confirming itself and these very sort of Roman legal categories. So I think just to bracket out there. But in terms of the main question, we should address is, you mentioned earlier this term breeding. I mean, this is where me and Nietzsche absolutely just break. There's a great quote from the second volume of your work, actually. You said you define breeding as the transformation of the material conditions conducive to different kinds of political organizations, which create different types of morality, in turn grounded in different conditions of power and happiness, which finally produce different types of value agents through the materially motivated internationalization of those moral systems in individuals. Now, are you breaking of Nietzsche when he's talking about breeding here? I can't remember the German. Because the thing about breeding is it has an inherent linkage to the past in a way more than the future. When one asks the breeding, it's more where did it come from, not where is it going, in a way. There's the creation, there's the affirmation in the Twilight of the Idols, of course, of the creativity of childbearing, but it's not necessarily framed in terms of breeding. It's framed in terms of the act of creation itself, which does not necessarily have to be tied back to a past childbearing, but instead, of course, it's always presented in this incredibly fetishistic, almost kind of way for Nietzsche. But to that extent, the late Nietzsche, does he stick with this theory of breeding? And are you breaking with a theory of breeding here? Because the notion of breeding has so many of these connotations by political. Of course, Nietzsche was very much interested in Darwin. Is this a kind of creative rereading of an idea of changing how subjectivity or consciousness is produced insofar as consciousness is a social product? Are you breaking with Nietzsche, or are you modifying it, or is this a part where you think we need to sort of break with any sort of Nietzschean theory of biology or any Nietzschean interaction with the biological, insofar as what we're trying to get at is not, say, as Heidegger would say, the overman? We could probably have a good idea what Heidegger was really thinking when he said that, as opposed to amor fati. The actual, you know, is insofar as a life can be bred, which is not have, it does not have to justify itself, would it therefore sort of breed itself out of the possibility of any thinking of anything in terms of this fundamental debt to one's lineage, to one's inheritance, the concept of breeding presupposes?
At the end of the day, I think I'm breaking somewhat with his use of the term, but trying to do so in the spirit of his goal, right, of his purposes. So it's a critical reinterpretation. And when I talk about the politics of breeding, I'm really interested only in the late work where he raises the concept in the context of how do you bring about higher types. And the word Zuchtung is translatable as either breeding or cultivation. And I think that's intentional that Nietzsche's drawn to this term, because at the end of the day, he's reducing the distance between the anthropological and the zoological, as well as the distance between the zoological and the biological, right? He wants to sort of say this isn't a concept of biological breeding. It's not a concept of metaphorical psychological breeding. It applies across the board. Breeding refers to producing future types by changes to the conditions in the present that caused them. And what counts as breeding, if we ask, well, is this a biological concept? Is it a cultural concept? What counts is anything that does that, right? He's not excluding anything, and he's not focusing on anything. As you mentioned, he has an interest in evolution. He has an interest in biology and biological science. He has this strangely semi-Lamarckian idea that if I engage in a habit over the course of my life, my children will inherit it. And he's interested in these things because he's interested in what can we do today that will produce a change in people tomorrow. Anything that will do that counts, right? So if that means changing diets, that's breeding. If it means changing political systems, that's breeding. If it means changing educational systems, it's breeding. The contrast is, first of all, to taming, right? He contrasts this animal metaphor of breeding an animal versus taming an animal. Taming an animal is removing objectionable characteristics and eliminating types that I find objectionable, whereas breeding involves preserving characteristics that I find desirable. So the politics of breeding is first and foremost preservative rather than destructive. I ask, which human beings do we want to save? Which characteristics that some lucky hits have do we want future human beings to have? And what conditions brought those characteristics about? So it could be dangerous, but it could be dangerous in the way that any politics is dangerous. Any politics can use objectionable means towards its ends. The language of breeding, I think, is really interesting because towards the end of his work, he moves away from the metaphor of animal breeding, and he talks more and more about the cultivation of plants. His primary picture of the conditions that produce higher types becomes the hothouse, the greenhouse, rather than the barnyard. So in that sense, I think it's more appropriate to define breeding as cultivation, because in his final work, that's the image he uses. And I think it's the more materialist picture, because when you think of a greenhouse, you're no longer thinking of the breeder, right? You don't have a person coming in to select animals. Secondly, you're focused on the material foundations, the soil, the light, the water. Those are what produce this plant instead of that plant. So I think that's the better metaphor for thinking about his late theory of breeding. I'm not sure if that answers the question.
Maybe a final.
It's interesting you mentioned the focus on plants, actually, because it seems like it was probably due to his Goethean inflections, because Goethe famously wrote an amazing book on plants, which is very influential around that sort of scene, as well as the earlier German idealists like Schelling, too.
I also think it's an important way of sort of moving away from an anthropocentric understanding of the origins of human beings and moralities, but at the same time also moving away from the animalistic picture, because the animalistic picture pushes us in certain ways. And I think he realizes, having used that metaphor for so long, or that language for so long, he realizes it's pushing in a certain direction that he doesn't want to go. It's still a kind of intentionalistic picture. Animals as these beasts that desire to dominate their environment. Instead, think of a plant. What does a plant want? A plant wants to grow. It wants light. It wants sun. So it's a very different way of thinking about our motivation. It's very against the grain of the humanistic tradition.
Mm.
I think this raises the question. This can be a final question. I don't want to take too much of your time today, Donovan. I want to say thank you in advance for spending time with us here today. This has been great. But on the point of higher types, if we are combining or morphing the sort of Nietzschean lens with a kind of socialist or Marxian lens, and if it's in our interest to develop, you know, this sort of relative sense of equality amongst, you know, folks in a society, how are we to rethink? Does this force us then to rethink what even Nietzsche thinks about higher types? And also perhaps denude it of some of the moral connotations that go with it, since we are thinking as materialists. And maybe even if our interest is to give life and to give voice for to those things that are ordinarily suppressed or dominated in the sort of qualitative version of a pathos of distance, how do we then suppress or evaluate or criticize the sort of eugenic connotation that goes with higher types?
Right. This is a great question. And all of this ultimately goes back to this debate about the nature of will to power, his understanding of our motivation, and the conflicting conceptions of higher types he gives us at different places in his work and at different periods in his work. So we have to make the case for one of these understandings of the criterion of higher types. We have to reject those versions of the criterion for higher type that lead necessarily to a quantitative picture of the will to power, a comparative superiority-based picture of the pathos of distance, a conception of amor fati, where my ability to affirm my fate has to do with my sense of accomplishment of ever greater conquests and so on. So we have to reject that entire side, which I've tried to argue doesn't go nearly as deep as it appears. And once we've done that, we have to push for the view that higher types doesn't mean, you know, a world in which we preserve the categories of the high and the low, but where we're trying to produce a population of people who are all in type, the higher type. And the higher type then is defined by the intensity of the feeling of power rather than a quantitative state of power. And I actually sort of play with this idea a little bit in the book when I suggest, well, when you're reading Nietzsche about aristocratic culture producing this desire for self-overcoming and so on, you think of these very heroic images of people accomplishing great things and standing out above everyone else in terms of their abilities and their accomplishments. And we should push in a very different direction. We should say that Nietzsche's psychology, Nietzsche's understanding of human nature, the pleasure we take in resistance for its own sake, is best exemplified not in those heroic images, but maybe better exemplified in Marx's picture of that day I spend fishing and, you know, farming and engaging in idle criticism. Or I also suggest the image of Zhuangzi's useless tree, right? That kind of very small, almost humble, quiet form of life can be every bit as rich in the feeling of power if the basis of power is proportionate resistance, as the Homeric heroes, right? And maybe that's the picture of contentment of a sort we should be pushing for in our reading of Nietzsche.
You're speaking my language. And Donovan, I want to thank you once again for coming on the show. You have your two-volume series. Will there be a third installment?
Oh, God, I hope not. No. I'm certainly probably going to be writing from this point in directions that are sort of traced by this book, but I can't imagine directly adding a third volume. It was just it was a lot. And I need a little bit of a break from these particular topics.
This is the problem with modern audiences. They just want sequels.
Yeah, that's right.
A remake. Yes, and you did offer me some of the books prior to our discussion, but I was fine with the PDFs. As you can see on my video, I have too many books already. Yeah. But you were generous to suggest perhaps, my suggestion was is that if you are still willing, that we can do them as a giveaway on our Twitter account. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. Sounds great.
Yeah, so if you're listening to the show right now, probably within the day or two following it, you can just pop onto our Twitter account and find the tweet that's going to have the episode and the offer for the books. Just retweet that, and then after a day or two, we'll pull a lucky winner. There will be a lucky hit, an Amor Fati for the books. So just tune in and find us on Twitter. Thanks again, Donovan. This has been wonderful.
Yeah, thanks so much for the invitation. It's been great. And thank you, Adam and Billy, for your great questions and the really interesting discussion. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you, Donovan.
No, thank you so much for coming.